Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, told Zelensky, "Be strong, be brave, be fearless. You are never alone, dear President." Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz said his country would always support Ukraine. "We must never confuse aggressor and victim in this terrible war," he said. Only Hungary's Viktor Orban took Trump's side. Donald Trump evidently wants to return world politics to spheres of influence, with the U.S. in control of the Americas, China predominant in Asia, and Russia the principal power in Europe. With U.S.-Russia relations moving toward normalcy, and Israel in the driver's seat in the Middle East, all it takes to realize Trump's vision is for China to bend to Trump on trade. Principles, values, and commitments are out the window. Pure self-interest in a world run by autocrats is all that matters. What can possibly go wrong? I'm Mel Gertal for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 4th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Mike Moan. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the KBOO Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. So this episode is part three of our deep dive into the Forest Service's proposal to amend the Northwest Forest Plan, which covers 24 million acres over 17 national forests spread across Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. As I've said before, it's one of the primary reasons we have any intact or recovering forests left in the Pacific Northwest. So it's kind of a big deal. In previous episodes, we explored incorporating tribal inclusion and traditional ecological knowledge with tribal advocate and fire practitioner Ryan Reed, and we also explored labor exploitation in the forestry workforce with Manuel Machado. You can find those and all of our episodes, and I promise we cover more than just the Northwest Forest Plan. You can find all that on our Coast Range Radio feed of Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. What we haven't done yet, or at least not in a while, is gone in depth with the conservation and environmental perspective. So for a completely non-biased, totally neutral take on the good, the bad, and the complicated of the Northwest Forest Plan and the proposed amendments, and a lot more, I'm joined by Grace Brailer, Wildlands Director at Cascadia Wildlands. Before we get started, if you appreciate the show, as I've said before, please help grow our audience. Thank your local radio station, share the show with a friend, or go on your favorite podcast app and give us a 5-star rating. All those things really help. They're quick and free. And if you have any feedback or guest ideas, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Grace, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you again.
Likewise.
We have a lot to get into. Let's start, just for the benefit of anyone not familiar, with a really basic overview of the Northwest Forest Plan. I talked about the general area it covered. Mm-hmm. Could you just talk in broad strokes about what it does?
Sure. So this was a plan developed and adopted 30 years ago, so all the way back in 1994. It was developed in response to really destructive, intensive logging practices that were happening on our public lands out across this region. It covers the area utilized by the northern spotted owl. So this species is an old growth dependent species that was being driven to extinction, you know, not doing well in response to all of the logging that was taking place on our public lands. So this plan originally developed to protect and ideally maintain and develop additional older forests for that species to utilize. But of course, there are other components to it as well. So it sets up a system of land use allocations or areas that will dictate what can happen and where. So it's broken down into, there's a system of reserves that are focused on developing that older forest. And then on the other hand, there's what's called the matrix, which is where timber harvest is prioritized. And so there are boundaries that then dictate the management of forests within those areas. And there are also various provisions to protect aquatic habitat and more, but that's the general overview.
So let's go from what the Northwest Forest Plan was and currently is to the future. So the Forest Service has proposed some pretty major amendments to it. Could you start us off with just kind of bullet points? What are their specific proposals, like the different action alternatives, and which one are they proposing to go with? And then We'll kind of dig deeper into all that.
Sure. So the agency is proposing amendments, and it has laid those out and analyzed the impacts of those in what is called a draft environmental impact statement, or DEIS, as you'll hear it referred to. So in a DEIS, in this environmental analysis document, the agency has to look at and prepare what's called a no action alternative. So that is one, and that's just the baseline that would leave the Northwest Forest Plan as it currently is and make no changes. And then there are a few action alternatives. So in addition to that is alternative B, which is what the agency has designated as its proposed action. And this is largely based off of a set of recommendations that were approved by a federal advisory committee to the agency. Alternative C, then, in addition to that, would include most of the components of alternative B, but it would include less mechanical treatments or logging, and is somewhat more vague on its management commitments. And then alternative D is also similar to alternative B, but it would include the highest amount of mechanical treatment in forests, so logging, and an exemption for survey and manage requirements to look out for certain species adjacent to communities. And it also includes some additional recommendations related to tribal inclusion that were recommended by the Federal Advisory Committee, but not all of which were included in alternative B.
Yeah, so it's a little complicated. Well, it's a lot complicated, but What they've done here from my, you know, you're a lawyer, I'm not. From my layperson perspective, it's really complicated how they've included certain aspects in one or two, but not the other. And some of it seems really arbitrary from my perspective. But just real quick, you know, my understanding is that the environmental and conservation community is not thrilled about any of these alternatives, correct?
I think that's fair to say, yeah.
Right. And obviously, alternative D is kind of the worst case scenario of the proposals. And we're going to go into kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and a couple of the more interesting pieces to grapple with. But first, I just want to get your take on how the Forest Service's stated what they call purpose and need aligns with what they're saying they want to do. You know, in other words, do you think they're following the science? Do you think they're operating in good faith here?
Sure, that's a good question. So in preparing the draft environmental impact statement, the purpose and need really is what formed the basis of the range of alternatives that the agency prepares, so that menu of options that it gives itself. So a lot of what we look for is that purpose and need sufficiently responsive to what's going on? Is it too narrow? Is it kind of dictating the outcomes later on? So in this document, the agency is describing its purpose and need, essentially noting that it's been 30 years. It is time for an update to this majorly impactful plan. We have learned a lot about wildfire, uncharacteristically severe wildfires that have longer seasons here in the Pacific Northwest, and how that impacts communities. We've learned a lot about climate change and various impacts and our need to bolster resilience into the future and utilizing older forests and habitat to do so. And of course, indigenous knowledge. So the original plan was passed without incorporation of indigenous knowledge, without the direct involvement of our native tribes and indigenous communities here in the region. And so that is first and foremost the most glaring mistake that was made when passing this original plan. So the Forest Service was actually, in describing its purpose and need, expressing that it wanted to address those shortcomings and also respond to what we've seen change over the past three decades. In addition to that, providing a predictable supply of timber products is one of the main goals. So there's, of course, always this economic component that is tied to managing forests. But, you know, of course, there's always non-timber related economic benefits that are tied to managing forests as well, and leaving forests intact, drinking water filtration and outdoor recreation, all of those benefits as well.
Yeah, and it's important to put in that economic piece because that is part of their mandate. Now, the question of whether they're thinking about that too much is certainly at least an open question. So honestly, the question around whether the Forest Service is operating in good faith or bad faith, that's kind of woven throughout all of this. And so I think that's something maybe we'll touch on throughout this conversation. But I want to learn more about the actual quote-unquote action alternatives that are being proposed. So real quick, could you just give us an overview of kind of the good, the bad, the complicated? What are some of the worst and best aspects?
Sure. I'll keep it couched mostly in the agency's proposed action, alternative B,
yeah,
because that's where they did the most full analysis in the document. But, you know, there are some really concerning changes being proposed in there. First and foremost, redefining what would be considered mature and old growth forest. So bumping up the age of management, say in moist reserve forest, it would bump it from 80 to 120. So in forests, you know, 120 years old now and younger, they would be able to log in those areas. In dry forests, they would bump that age up to 150 years old. Mm-hmm. They would establish, you know, protections for big trees, but not big stands. So a lot of the logging practices could take place in and around those older trees. You know, there are exceptions for infrastructure. So say these what we call loopholes, where the agency can use exceptions for roads or landing areas to be placed then through the biggest, oldest trees. And, you know, we've seen that firsthand when field checking timber sale proposals that will conflict. And so that is very concerning. You know, of course, there are some really ambitious timber targets that are proposed. So logging a certain amount of acreage or producing a certain amount of timber volume in the next 10 or 15 years, that's really concerning, mainly because of a mistrust in agency, you know, fear of say agency capture by the timber industry or that focus on extraction, over extraction that we see. The commercial incentive is still there. So seeing the agency propose these timber output targets that would so significantly increase volume coming out of national forests, that's concerning because we know that the agency is saying that it wants to address climate change or reduce wildfire impacts, seeing these really dramatically heightened logging outputs and, you know, ages of forests being targeted for those outputs, that's where it's concerning.
Yeah, and some of those age designations seem so arbitrary, mm-hmm. at least from my layperson perspective. From my reading, and I try to give the Forest Service a fair shake whenever possible, but it's really hard to square their stated purpose and need with what they're actually proposing from my perspective. I also want to talk about the tribal inclusion piece, because that's one of the things that I think most of us agree is kind of one of the unalloyed benefits of this proposal and long overdue. I know that you put a lot of effort into a recent sign-on letter that you all are putting out that talks about support for tribal inclusion. So could you just talk about what you're asking for around that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as we said, it was one of the biggest, most glaring mistakes of the development of the original plan was the exclusion of tribal nations and indigenous knowledge. You know, in making these decisions, agencies are generally required to follow best available science. Well, that needs to, but has not up to now included indigenous knowledge. So efforts by the Forest Service to include components in the plan that would meaningfully advance tribal inclusion, respect tribal sovereignty, those are all long overdue and positives to these proposed changes. So what we are attempting to do to show support from that, including from conservation organizations like ourselves, is we partnered with the folks at FUSI and FireGen, and have prepared a sign-on letter, both for organizations across the nation that are interested, as well as individuals, to sign on to this letter, just showing broad support for all of the tribal inclusion components analyzed in the draft environmental impact statement to be included in any final decision to amend the plan. As I mentioned, they're kind of scattered throughout, mostly in alternative B, but there are some that were in alternative D that were not included. And so it's a little bit messy, and we just want to make sure that all of those end up being prioritized and approved in a final agency decision. So this was, you know, developed with direct input and guidance from tribal partners and representatives, both who, you know, took part in the Federal Advisory Committee process and have provided guidance after. But it is the ask that it is, because we don't want it to preclude tribes or stakeholders, and just making a very distinct distinguishment that tribes are not stakeholders, but that other stakeholders could then, you know, advocate for alternatives or versions of alternatives, and that we can make this clear statement of support for tribal inclusion components that does not conflict with those efforts.
Right.
But doesn't necessarily, you know, preclude advocating for conservation safeguards. I don't want it to be misconstrued to imply that, if you will.
Aside from this sign-on letter, how are you at Cascadia Wildlands, and I know you're also a part of various alliances and coalitions of groups, how are you responding to this draft environmental impact statement, and how can listeners learn more, get involved, take action, you know, submit comments, things like that?
Yeah, we have been tracking this process from the start, but especially since the release of the draft environmental impact statement, we've been digging in and analyzing it, and then in doing so, partnering with other groups to, you know, draft our technical comment letters on the plan, but also provide resources so that folks can go to our website. By the time this is aired, we will have resources available on our website for folks to see, learn more, see exactly how to submit a comment to the agency. We have until March 17th is the end of this public comment period. And so, you know, taking time between now and then to sign onto petitions and joint comment letters that we can submit, but also, especially importantly, sharing your own personal identity and connection to these forests, concerns about whether that be climate or wildfire resilience, indigenous inclusion, sharing those comments as personalized as you feel up for doing, sharing those directly with the agency is always best. They've said, particularly with this project with this process, the agency really does want to hear public feedback between draft and ultimate decisions. So they're open to feedback on this. So, you know, take the time to do that, please.
Yeah. Absolutely. And like you say, it'll be up on your website, caskwild.org. We'll have it in the show notes of our podcast episode for this. And depending on when you're listening to this, March 17th may be coming right up. Mm-hmm. And let me just say, it is so important that everyone listening to this takes the time to look over those resources, submit comments, whatever the outcome is, it is so important that we all take a minute and show the Forest Service and the federal government how special and how important these places are to us. You, Grace, are a lawyer and an expert, and you are going to write really smart, incisive comments. Folks like me and folks listening, we don't have to do that. Just say how you feel about these places and what values are important for you. So don't be intimidated by the complexity of it. You can write just really heartfelt statements, or you can get as wonky as you want. Mm-hmm. So before we move off the Northwest Forest Plan, I want to talk about fire for a minute, because fire really overlays so much of what is happening right now, so much of the management decisions that are being talked about. But where do you think the Forest Service is getting it right and wrong with their approach to fire? And I apologize if that's too big a question to answer in a nutshell. But just like in general, do you think they're approaching land management decisions as it relates to fire with an ecological lens, or as stated in a recent Columbia Insight article where they got a hold of internal Forest Service documents, that they are using the threat of wildfire to justify meeting higher timber targets?
Yeah, I mean, how incredibly concerning that our public agency on our public lands would manipulate the very real serious threat of wildfire to communities to increase logging. What you asked, what the Forest Service in this particular proposal is getting right, is the inclusion of cultural burning, use of prescribed fire as an effective way to ecologically manage forests. You know, certainly these forests evolved with fire. So outright suppression, as we've seen, is not natural and has resulted in conditions that are not resilient to climate change or the more dramatic, uncharacteristically severe wildfires that we've seen. You know, with that, our job opportunities, workforce development, youth training, an abundance of opportunities there. So what they're getting wrong, as you mentioned, is then using the threat of wildfire to increase logging targets, you know, especially with that more intense, those more intense logging prescriptions or practices closer to industrial logging. Those significantly increase wildfire risk. Thinning in the backcountry increases wildfire risk, is not going to help communities. So what the Forest Service can get right is focusing on community preparedness, home hardening, you know, managing areas immediately adjacent to communities that can then be protected or are better equipped to face wildfire events. So an investment in that is what is warranted and what we've seen science to show is most effective. But, you know, widespread thinning across landscapes, that's not the ticket.
Yeah, it has no impact on keeping our homes and communities from burning down. And as Ralph Bloomers pointed out in an earlier episode that I did with him, if you just do the math on how much land the Forest Service would have to treat to have statistical likelihood of a fire encountering those treated areas within 5 years of treatment, it's just an impossible task in the near time scale here. So like you say, they should be focusing their efforts where it matters the most, directly adjacent to communities. The final question on the Northwest Forest Plan, what's your dream scenario here? Like, it is true that, you know, as we've talked about, tribes have a right to be stewarding this land and we need to be repairing those past harms. We do have to address the fire situation. We are in the midst of a climate crisis. So what should the Forest Service be looking at? Not drilling down into like they should be doing this, that, and the other thing, but how should they be thinking about this in a way that they're not?
Sure. You know, I guess my dream scenario would be, first and foremost, prioritization of Indigenous co-stewardship, point blank. And then prioritization of fish and wildlife habitat restoration, connectivity, managing to see our incredibly significant climate forests, seeing them forward as refugia for species, managing for water quality, for drinking water quality and quantity, you know, focusing fire resilience efforts close to homes and communities, building in those safeguards to ensure that remaining pockets of and swaths of old growth forest can thrive into the future, managing for a diversity of ecosystems and fire regimes, really just a more holistic look, I suppose, at ecological health and well-being. And at the root of that is, you know, indigenous knowledge and co-stewardship, and then all of the amazing co-benefits that we see from managing for old growth forest conditions. Those are really what we have to prioritize, you know, in this shrinking window of possibility to take action to curb the worst impacts of climate change, biodiversity loss. To get personal, I want to be able to take my niece, who's 1 year old, I want to take her out into these forests in the future when she comes to visit me. So just ensuring that these ecosystems can thrive moving forward, not separate from, but with humans and critters and all the things.
I really share that vision. And I would just add real quick, a couple episodes ago, I interviewed Manuel Machado, who is a researcher with OSU, about labor issues. And mm-hmm. something that is in my dream scenario is that the Forest Service talks about, and they have as kind of part of their founding mandate, support for rural economies. But Manuel, I can't remember if it's his research or just research he was referencing, but the Forest Service has actually acknowledged in some of their documents that most of the economic benefits, even out in the backcountry, they flow back into the cities. And they don't address in any real way how to deal with that. And so if you're going to be talking about needing to support communities economically, that's fine. I totally support that. I live rurally. I am absolutely pro sustainable logging, but I would like to see them actually grappling with how to help support the communities, not just the mill owners.
Mm-hmm, totally.
So let's step back a bit. You touched on this a little, but in the midst of all of this, in the midst of the Northwest Forest Plan, the aborted National Old Growth Amendment, we are in the midst of the Trump administration's assault on basically everything. I've heard a lot of people talk about how concerned they are that regardless of what happens with the Northwest Forest Plan, even more bedrock environmental protections could be under threat. So what is most concerning to you, and what are you tracking? How concerned are you about what's happening at the federal level right now, writ large?
Very, to put most simply. I don't want to sugarcoat it. I'm incredibly concerned. There are attacks being launched constantly. First and foremost, NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, that is our way to, as public, have a voice or at least be informed. It doesn't dictate, of course, what decision agencies ultimately make, but it does provide a lot of sideboards to that, and is our one way to know what's going on and what's being proposed, what goes into those decisions. So attacks on that or attempts to streamline NEPA analyses to the point where then it just shuts out the public, and we don't know what then is going on the lands that are supposed to be stewarded in the public trust for our benefit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, us and future generations. So I'm very concerned about that. And then, of course, the Endangered Species Act is one of the most powerful tools in our environmental toolbox, if you will. That is under constant threat. I think I'm just constantly concerned about who's influencing these decisions, and, you know, the power imbalances that go into it, the undue influence of the much more moneyed interests, you know, that then trickle down and impact our forests and decisions that are made there. So yeah, concerned, to say the very least.
You know, there is so much happening right now that for a lot of folks, you know, why pay attention to forests when it feels like democracy is crumbling or you know, this and that. And obviously there's more happening than we can possibly all pay attention to and resist. Here in the Northwest, our forests, as most people know, sequester more carbon, especially west of the Cascades, than anywhere else on Earth per acre. These are critical habitats for endangered species and for carbon sequestration. And when you cut these forests down, we don't get those back. So that is why, to me, forest protection is so critical right now, even among all of the other critical things. It's one of those things, like climate, that if we get it wrong now, we don't get it back. We don't get to try again later. Mm-hmm. So with that, as we wrap up, is there anything we've missed? And one more time, how do you recommend for listeners to get involved and take action?
I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
So I certainly just encourage folks to check out the resources that will be on our website, engage with, you know, ours and other organizations that align with your values and, you know, seek what resonates with you and then take action, take the next step. It can be as simple as adding your name to a petition, or you can go the extra mile and submit your own unique comments to the agency, but it really does matter. I know that there are a lot of asks, and it feels like our attention is being drawn in so many different ways, but this is worthy of attention. It could have lasting impacts for so many of us.
Will have lasting impacts, absolutely. And one more time, that website is?
CaskWild.org, CaskWild.org.
Grace, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for all your hard work. I have so much respect for the work you do. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate you having me on and all of your ongoing efforts.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Once again, please take just a minute, share this show with your friends, give us a rating or review if you listen to us on a podcast app, and if you listen to us on your community radio station, tell them how much you appreciate them for what they do. As I said last week, those in power right now want us to feel hopeless and powerless and overwhelmed. Not giving in to that is an act of resistance. So keep your head up, take care of yourself, take care of others, and stay in the fight. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We'll be back next week.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance